From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Political party conventions in this country used to actually decide things. Not so much anymore. Sure, there's still drama, but mostly they're coronations of the candidate who survived the slog of the primaries and the caucuses. It's been more than 60 years since a nomination vote went past a first ballot, but it didn't used to be that way. In 1924, it took the Democrats 103 ballots to pick their guy. But now you're hearing talk about contested conventions again because Donald Trump. Some Republican Party leaders are hoping they can outmaneuver the frontrunner at the convention this year, all of which is giving us an opportunity to talk about how conventions work and the crazy history of conventions, which is fun to talk about, and it just may help us make sense of what could happen this year. Join us after the news.
Friend, follow, and join us on social media to stay connected with the latest goings-on. Find out who's on Radio West tomorrow, what's happening on Capitol Hill, and get a glimpse behind the microphones with pictures and videos of station staff and special events. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter. Search for KUER 90.1.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For the first time in the modern political era, a time dominated by constant media coverage, political observers are actually talking about the real possibility of a contested convention. Now, not everyone agrees about the chances of this happening, but it's certainly more likely than it has been in decades. Most of the time, and you've probably heard it described this way, conventions are coronations of a candidate who's already been selected by primary and caucus voters. And so there's lots of primetime ceremony and free advertising. But this time around, Republican Party leaders are looking to the mostly dormant process of the convention to deny Donald Trump the nomination, all of which is giving us an opportunity to talk about how this process is supposed to work and how it used to work. There's some good stories that come with the history of American party conventions. We'll talk about some of those today with Ron Elving. He's senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News, and he's joining us today from the studios of NPR in Washington. And Ron Elving, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Tim Chambliss will also be with us throughout the hour. He's an assistant professor and lecturer in the Department of Political Science here at the University of Utah. He's affiliated with the university's Hinckley Institute of Politics. And Tim Chambliss, welcome to you.
Great to be here.
Well, Ron Elving, we'll talk about particulars as we go along, but give us a sense, first of all, how did political party conventions used to work in a time before, you know, multimedia and sophisticated party techniques? I mean, what was the idea of them in the early days?
The idea of the conventions is a lot like the idea of any convention, whether it's a church group or a commercial group or any other kind of organization. It's a chance for people to get together and actually do business face-to-face. And if you're talking about a national convention, the sort of thing that obviously in the 1800s would not be contemplated lightly, a lot of travel was involved. These conventions got started just as about the same time railroads were getting to be common.
Right.
And people had to travel a great distance. And when they got there, they were serious about conducting real business and making real decisions. And for most of the history of the conventions, that's what they did. The delegates were empowered to choose a presidential nominee when we're talking about the national political conventions of the major parties. They chose the nominee. They adopted a platform. They approved a running mate for the nominee. And they made a lot of other decisions as well having to do with conducting party business.
I wonder, are they more democratic these days? I mean, you have a sense that in the old days, they were somewhat anti-democratic in the sense that you had party leaders doing all this maneuvering, and I'm not sure how much it mattered what rank-and-file voters had to say about it in those days.
Well, it's important to bear in mind that these conventions are functions of the parties themselves. They are not governmental institutions, strictly speaking. They're nominating people. And they are adopting policies for public affairs, for public office that will affect everyone eventually and become the government. But they are not in and of themselves actual government functions. They are the functions of the parties themselves, the free association of these parties, and they do make their own rules. And through most of their history, it probably never even occurred to them that they would not have their own party structures choose the delegates. Now, they did have primaries. The primaries date back to the early years of the 1900s, very early years of the 1900s. A few progressive states adopted it. And they expected those primaries to have an effect on the convention, to actually express the will of the people. But really, through most of the 20th century, the delegations were still dominated by the choices of the party officials, the party bosses, if you will, the people who were in elected office in each state, in each party, and also the party leadership itself, the chairman of the party, the people who served on the National Party Committee. They made the decision as to who would go to the convention, and there were, of course, a lot of influential groups who were part of that decision. But that was essentially how it got done. And then, starting with 1972 and the Democratic Party, the majority of delegates, this was after the fiasco of Chicago in 1968, the majority of delegates were actually chosen directly or allocated directly by votes of people in primaries, and eventually that became dominant in the Republican Party as well.
So what's happening today with Donald Trump? I mean, you hear him talking about the magic number of delegates is 1237. Now, he's not there. He could get there, and we'll talk about the particulars as we go along. But what he's said is, let's say I don't get that magic number. That I still have a plurality of votes, so I should then be the nominee. But I guess, Ron Elving, what you're saying is it doesn't necessarily work that way. Is that right?
It doesn't work that way, because on the first ballot, they will take a plebiscite, if you will, of all the delegates. And if you have half the delegates plus one, that's enough to be nominated in either party. Now, it used to take a two-thirds vote. Imagine how much more difficult that would be to achieve. But let's not go back that far in history just now. Donald Trump would only need to have half plus one, a majority of the delegates. Now, he has started describing that 1,237 as a arbitrary number. Well, it's only arbitrary in the sense that in mathematics, when you do a function, if you do a formula such as figuring a majority of a given number, then you are going to have a single number that is not really arbitrary at all. It's just the factual existence of a majority within a group. And this group is the number of delegates to the convention, and 1237 represents the barest majority. So it's a real number, not just something that somebody made up.
Tim Chambliss, what are you making of what's happening, right? You must be, as an historian, in some ways kind of excited about the prospects of July.
There is nothing like this in the textbooks in our governmental history. Going back to the creation of the emergence of the Republican Party in 1854, its first convention in 1856, we can see 10 times in the history of the Republican Party with its conventions where the party went to a second, third ballot, many ballots. There's no mention legally of political parties or political conventions in the U.S. Constitution, the basis for all U.S. law. So what we have here is what George Washington first declared, an ongoing experiment in democracy. And just as friends can disagree and lawyers and judges can disagree, spouses can disagree, delegates to party conventions can disagree. And we certainly see this in 2016.
Was part of the system, and I want to get you on this as well, Ron, was part of the system, Tim Chambliss, designed to sort of strip out in some way that knee-jerk feeling of emotion from the masses and get to this idea of pragmatism, strip out the element of the heart and work on the element of the head? What, you know, who can practically be elected in November?
Yes, because the party leaders were concerned with power, acquiring power and keeping power. And so they were looking for an individual who could win the votes of those who were qualified to vote. Back prior to the Civil War, we were really looking at white males. So the constituencies, the voting constituencies have greatly changed since 1856. In our lifetime, going back 64 years to 1952 is the last time that we saw the Republican Party nearly have a brokered convention. They actually had a roll call vote, and then they declared that the vote did not count. So on the official ballot, a general who had never run for a public office before, who was now retired as a general, was elected on the first ballot. And with the Democratic Party going back to 1940 at the outset of World War II, again, it came down to choosing a leader during difficult times.
Yeah. Ron Elving, what about that idea, the idea that party leaders are, and a convention is designed to sort of cool the passions of the masses and come up with something more practical? It seems like that's a question for this particular race.
Yes, it is. And we certainly have seen a great deal of emotion, passion. Sometimes when you use the word emotion, it sounds a little bit derogatory, as though you're suggesting some decision is not being made with the head. When you say passion, on the other hand, that has somewhat more of an admiring air to it, as though when passion is involved, people should follow their heart. You'll get that argument, I think, quite a bit in Cleveland, possibly in Philadelphia as well, when we get to July, because there are a lot of people in the country who feel as though Washington is not just not doing that well, that Washington is not merely dysfunctional, that it has somehow become a real gridlocked non-entity in terms of improving people's lives, and that something needs to be done that tears up the current arrangement of power in Washington root and branch.
What's the essential purpose of a convention? We'll talk about the uniqueness of this year, but in modern American politics, what purpose does a convention generally serve these days? Ron Elving,
I would say that what it has come to be in the last several decades is increasingly it's become a four-day, four-night infomercial for the party in question, that it is heavily covered on television. It used to be that it was the only thing you could see on television when we only had three networks, broadcast networks. They all three carried all of the nights of the convention, and sometimes they would carry the daytime events as well. And it was just considered to be the whole country was supposed to supposedly sit down and watch the convention during that particular week, which, of course, not everyone did, but it was all over the television. And so gradually the parties got the idea that they didn't want to have big disputes. They didn't want to have fights on the floor. And again, the 1968 Democratic Convention was the watershed here. And even though we have had some somewhat contentious conventions since then, it's been nothing like what they used to be because they realize they're on television, and this is their best chance to influence voters. So it's really become a tightly controlled, scripted coronation for the nominee, whose identity is usually quite certain, sometimes only slightly uncertain. And this is what the conventions have become, or in some sense devolved to, because they don't really make a lot of decisions.
You can really make your name at these conventions, whether you're the nominee or not. I mean, Barack Obama certainly did. Bill Clinton certainly did, it seems.
You know, again, that's really a function of how much media coverage they still do get. It's a little different now. It's not the networks all the time. It's mostly the cables that are on it all the time and the social media. And yes, Barack Obama's speech, not at the convention that nominated him, but 4 years earlier in 2004, really made his reputation.
All right. Well, let's talk about some history. And Tim Chambliss, let's go way back, because I know you've thought a bit about you mentioned 1854 was like the first.
The emergence of the Republican Party.
Right. We don't need to say too much about it, but is it true that Abraham Lincoln, it took him 10 ballots?
There was considerable discussion actually on the third ballot when he was nominated. And he had the advantage that the convention was held in Chicago. He was a hometown boy. He was a compromise candidate between two powerful Republicans, Seward and Chase. And as was the common etiquette of the time, he did not attend the National Convention. But he was chosen. And then he, for the remaining 6 months of the campaign, did not leave the state of Illinois and spent less than $900 on his campaign. That was the first Republican convention. And it was made up of abolitionists and free soilers, individuals who simply wanted to keep slavery in the South and not have it spread to the North and to the West. And that was the party that Lincoln would represent as he came and became a wartime president.
$900
$900
Not real money in those days.
Right, yeah. Right. Now we're talking $3 billion in 2012 and maybe much more in 2016.
Well, let's move to the 20th century, 1912. This was an interesting moment, I think, and I know, Ron Alving, you know something about this, and Tim Chambliss, you too. Teddy Roosevelt and I guess it was William Howard Taft essentially got into a dispute, and this really split the Republican
vote. They were
vote.
Very good friends who became bad friends and were no longer on speaking terms. Taft got the nomination in 1908 when Theodore Roosevelt chose not to seek another term, and with Roosevelt's support. But they were no longer on speaking terms by 1912. Taft, being the incumbent, was able to use the power of the presidency to even deny the opportunity for Roosevelt at the party convention to be nominated. So he left. And in August, formed his own
Bull Moose Party.
The nickname was Bull Moose, the Progressive Party, at a time when maybe three quarters of Americans self-identified as liberals or progressives. And so in the election of 1912, a landmark election, we had four major candidates running. And Theodore Roosevelt got 27% of the popular vote to 23% to the incumbent President Taft. And Woodrow Wilson, barely. 42%, and 8% went to a socialist in federal prison, Eugene V. Debs.
Right.
So this may be the first time that we see someone who openly calls himself a socialist since the era of Eugene Debs get this close to the presidency.
It's the truth. And it makes me wonder, Ron Elving, about this specter of splitting the vote. Woodrow Wilson became president as a result of that infighting between Taft and Roosevelt. Is this a specter that we at least need to think about when we're talking about the Democratic side now, Sanders and Clinton?
There is a chance that one of those two candidates, not nominated, would splinter off and run as a third-party candidate. I don't think it's a strong chance at this point. The bitterness in that particular race is growing, but it is not necessarily out of control. There's a greater danger on the Republican side that if Donald Trump goes into the convention in Cleveland with the clear plurality of the delegates there, many more than any other candidate, and then having failed on the first ballot is ultimately denied the nomination, he might very well decide that he needs to run as a third-party candidate. Now, he has said that he wouldn't as long as he is, quote, treated fairly.
Right.
But he might not feel he'd been treated fairly if he had not most of the delegates, but a plurality of the delegates, and was still denied the nomination, which is right now pretty much the stated strategy of all the anti-Trump forces.
Let's talk about 1948, Tim Chambliss. This was a pretty deadlocked convention for the Republicans, was it not?
For the Republicans and for the Democrats.
Yeah.
And we now have television. Television first emerged just at the beginning of World War II, but now Americans are starting to acquire television after World War II. Television will be coming to Houston, Texas, where my folks bought a television to watch the conventions, and to Salt Lake City in 1952. But highly contested among the Republicans who thought that whoever got the nomination, it would be Thomas Dewey, the governor of New York, who had been a candidate in 1944, that they could have a Rose Garden strategy and not have to campaign in a highly active way, because the Democratic Party was split three ways, with Harry Truman, the unelected incumbent, holding the middle, and with J. Strom Thurmond, the segregationist Dixiecrat Democrat of South Carolina, walking out and taking his supporters with him, and with Henry Wallace on the left wing supporting the Soviet Union. And so as a result, the Democrats were perceived to be highly vulnerable to losing the election that they had held the White House for four terms.
You know, that's right. Henry Wallace was called himself a progressive, but was called many other things at the time. And he had actually been FDR's vice president from 1941 to 1945. There was enough feeling in the Democratic Party that he was unacceptably far left and friendly to the Soviet Union, so that in 1944 at the convention, the great controversy there was what to do about Henry Wallace. And it was possible for the powers that be in the Democratic Party, and largely from the South, but not only from the South, to issue an ultimatum, essentially, to FDR that he had to get someone else in Wallace's place. So Wallace, the Iowan, was replaced by Harry Truman, the Missourian, who had sort of a good Midwestern root, but also a Southern root, had been born in the part of Missouri that was most like the South. Little Dixie, they called it.
Yes. And everyone, of course, figures that the Governor Dewey is a lock for the race. And that brings us that iconic photograph, of course, of Truman.
Holding up the Chicago Tribune.
That's right.
It was quite amazing that here we have an unprecedented president elected four times, but gravely ill. As the 1944 election approached, and he was focusing all his energies upon World War II, and basically gave to the party bosses the decision to choose Roosevelt's third vice president in four terms.
That's amazing. Tim Chambliss is with us, a professor of political science here at the University of Utah. Ron Elving, also with us, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. If you have your own questions or comments, you can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a quick break, then be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, as Utahns head to caucuses to choose a candidate for president, we are talking about the political conventions coming in July. And why, you ask, would we be interested in the convention, which is a mostly ceremonial coronation in modern politics? Well, one of the reasons is Donald Trump, of course, the polarizing Republican frontrunner, as the party establishment kind of freaking out, and people are spinning these scenarios that could keep him from being the candidate in November. So we're talking about how the system works and also how it used to work, looking at the history of tumultuous conventions where frantic politicos were maneuvering and the outcome in some cases was really in question. Ron Elving is with us, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News, and Tim Chambliss, professor of political science at the University of Utah, joining us here in the studio. Here's a question from Kelly, who writes from West Jordan. How did the Democrats end up with superdelegates? She writes, I've heard it was kind of an effort by the party to exercise more control over the nominating process to make it less of a grassroots effort, less populist. Ron Elving, start with you on that question. And that's, I think, like that's going to come up this year with Democrats and Bernie Sanders.
It has been coming up quite a great deal. Bernie Sanders has been asking that same question, essentially. Why do we have superdelegates? Why don't we just allocate all the delegates on the basis of the votes in the primaries and the caucuses? That's the system. Why don't we just honor it? Well, going back to the 70s, 72, 76, mm-hmm. and 1980, the Democrats felt as though the system that they had installed, which of course they regarded as a great progressive step forward after the 68 convention, and the creation of this much more small-d democratic, almost plebiscitary system for choosing the delegates to the conventions, taking it out from the party power structure, they thought maybe we've gone a little too far. Maybe we've got a little too much populism, a little too much small-d democracy, and what we need is just a little more of that professionalism that's brought by people who are really seriously committed to this process and to this party. So they carved out, or they created an extra superstructure of superdelegates based on population and based on the voting performance of a given state, but carving out a special set of slots, seats at the convention, if you will, for anybody who was an elected party official at a certain level, like the governor or senators or members of Congress, and also for people who were members of the Democratic National Committee or state party chairs. And so suddenly you had an extra class, which has fluctuated a little in size and I think is right now about 20% of the overall total delegate population. These people are allowed to vote their conscience, if you will, or their professional judgment, if you will, and not necessarily bound by the exact vote in their home state.
I wonder, is there going to be, because this is it brings up the question of the rules. And Ron, one of the things you've talked about is the vote on the rules used to be the key vote, of, really, in some ways, of the entire convention. Would you talk a little bit about that? And do you think there's going to be a move to change the rules this year?
There almost certainly will be some discussion of changing the rules this year. There almost always is. The Democratic Party, generally speaking, argues about how to go forward with its rules, sometimes before the convention or sometimes during the convention, and certainly in the aftermath, especially if they lose the election in November. So we'll see. There's going to be a lot more focus on the superdelegates this year, no matter what happens in the outcome of the pledged delegates. But if Bernie Sanders overtakes Hillary Clinton in her lead on the pledged delegate side, that is, the delegates allocated by the actual voting and caucusing, then he is probably going to make a major effort to change the rules with respect to superdelegates and force them to vote the way their state voted. So that would redistribute their vote. If that's the vote Hillary Clinton is counting on to win, she might be in some degree of trouble. I don't necessarily predict or anticipate that happening, but that is a prospect, and that's one way the Democratic convention could blow up.
Yeah. Long shot, though, Ron, you think?
I'd say it's less than a 50-50 chance, certainly, and probably more like 1 in 4 or 1 in 3.
Tim Chambliss, you want to say anything about that?
1968, Hubert Humphrey received the Democratic Party nomination for president, although he had not entered any of the primaries. Backroom deals. This is after the trauma of the death of Robert Kennedy. Subsequently, the McGovern Commission said, we've got to change things. And so it was the pendulum effect. They went to the other extreme. And so there was chaos, essentially, at the 1972 convention. McGovern gave his acceptance speech in the middle of the night, and he won one state. So once again, party leaders decided to sculpture a mechanism that would hopefully allow party leaders to have an impact upon who could win. And that's what comes down today is superdelegates are looking to who can win, who can represent the party well before the voters. And in 2016, if Bernie Sanders can persuade superdelegates that maybe he can win more than, say, Hillary Clinton, then maybe superdelegates will start to shift their thinking and support a Sanders candidacy.
They did shift in 2008. They had initially been very, very much in support of Hillary Clinton in 2007 and early 2008. But as Barack Obama emerged as the champion of especially African-American voters, many of the superdelegates felt they could not deny him, particularly given the racial issue. They couldn't deny him their votes, and so he wound up prevailing among the superdelegates as well.
Yes.
You bring up 1968, Tim Chambliss, gives us an opportunity to talk about one of the most tumultuous political conventions in certainly in modern American history. Set this up for you. You already mentioned, of course, in 1968, Robert Kennedy wins the primary in California, is triumphant that night, and, of course, is assassinated. And 1968, there's a lot going on. Vietnam, of course, the debate about that, and it was a crazy political
It was
convention.
A crazy year, going back to April 4th of 1968 with the assassination of Dr. King.
Right.
And then no sooner is Bobby Kennedy declared the winner than he walks into the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel just after midnight and is shot. He actually dies at 2 a.m. the next day. So there's disarray within the Democratic Party. George McGovern emerges as a candidate at the Democratic Convention in August. Lyndon Johnson, who has announced on March 31st that he will not seek another term as president, supports his vice president, Hubert Humphrey. Humphrey gets the Democratic Party nomination without having been a candidate in the primaries. And in a three-man race, including George Wallace, a Democrat now, the Southern candidate of essentially the Dixiecrats in a three-man race in a very close election. Richard Nixon, will win the election, even though 6 years earlier he had declared that after losing the governorship of California.
You won't have Richard Nixon to kick around anymore.
That's exactly right. He lost by 350,000 votes to and as a result, the Republican Party is coming to power in 1969. The Democratic Party is in disarray.
Ron Elving, this gives us an opportunity to play one of my favorite clips from the 1968 convention. And it wasn't some grand speech. It was Dan Rather getting socked in the gut, which I think reveals the tumult that was going on in the streets outside of the convention, but also inside. Do you want to say something about this before we play this little moment?
It's hard to imagine, but let's hope we don't ever see anything quite like it again. There were many, many thousands of protesters who had gathered mostly to protest the war, but also to protest the system that was nominating someone who had never entered the primaries, as the professor just said. And that's something that I can still remember, having been a member of that generation, having watched this entire convention, every minute of it, all the coverage, in fact, many times. Mm-hmm. It was many people were still watching television in black and white in those days. But for those who had color, they could literally see the blood on the heads of these protesters in the streets. And there were fights inside the convention hall as well. And there was even a strong arm moment on the dais where the Speaker of the House had the gavel removed from his hand by a congressman who had been sent to do that by Mayor Richard Daley, who was directing the police who were beating the protesters out in the street. It was an extraordinary moment in American history.
And this moment is extraordinary. You'll hear this is live on CBS, Walter Cronkite trying to go to his correspondent there on the floor, Dan Rather.
Dan Rather?
What's your name, sir?
And what is your name, sir? Take your hands off of me.
Dan Rather?
Unless you intend to arrest me, don't push me, please.
Sir,
I know you won't, but don't push me. Take your hands off of me unless you plan to arrest me.
Wait a minute.
Walter, as you can see...
I don't know what's going on, but these are security people, apparently, around Dan. And obviously getting roughed up.
We tried to talk to the man, and we got bodily pushed out of the way. This is the kind of thing that's been going on outside the hall. This is the first time we've had it happen inside the hall. I'm sorry to be out of breath, but somebody belted me in his stomach during that. What happened is a Georgia delegate, at least he had a Georgia delegate sign on, was being hauled out of the hall. We tried to talk to him to see why, who he was, and what the situation was. And at that instant, the security people... Well, as you can see, put me on the deck. I didn't do very well.
I think we've got a bunch of thugs here.
Mm-hmm. Walter Cronkite referring to them as thugs.
That's right. And the American viewing public, seeing this, seeing the disorder, the disarray, the rioting essentially within the Democratic Party convention, and then outside seeing what will be later called a police riot, will finally determine that maybe it's time for a change. That after two terms, it's time to replace the Democratic Party with a Republican Party candidate because if they cannot manage their own convention and maintain order during the time of the Vietnam War and the Cold War, how can they indeed manage the country?
Ron Elving, you've said that in some ways the Democratic Party is still recovering from those optics in 68.
There was a good deal of controversy several years later in 1996 when the Democratic Party decided to go back to Chicago and have another convention, not in the same hall, but under a much, much happier set of circumstances with Bill Clinton more or less on cruise control toward reelection that fall. They went back. They had the convention in the Athletic Center where Michael Jordan won all of his titles. And that was a much happier event, and they tried to put the ghost of 1968 Chicago to rest. But I don't know that it was entirely successful because there will always lurk this sense that that was not only the violent end of the presidential hopes of the Democratic Party that year, but also the end in some respects of the entire FDR coalition stretching back to 1932, and this sense that the Democrats, if they could get their act together, would always hold the White House, and that they were the party of power. This seemed to be an abdication of all of that, and it also brought to an end the idea of the convention as being a fairly orderly thing run by the party and the party seniors, the party elders, that it could be something that they controlled and carried forward to nominate the candidate of their choice.
Ron Elving is with us, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. He's joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Tim Chambliss is here in our studios. He's a professor of political science at the University of Utah. And we'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the history and really the present also of political party conventions in this country. Ron Elving is joining us, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. Tim Chambliss, assistant professor and lecturer in the Department of Political Science at the University of Utah. He's also with the university's Hinckley Institute of Politics. Before we get to some more sort of practical questions for this season's convention, I want to ask one more question about a moment from history. This is 1964. This is in the Cow Palace, Tim Chambliss, in Daly City, just outside of San Francisco, sure. Of course. The Republicans are meeting. And this is remembered for that one line, of course, delivered by the conservative firebrand, Senator Barry Goldwater. I want to play this moment. I think it's an interesting piece of tape to contrast sort of what's happening today. You want to set this up for us? Give us the context of this moment, 64?
Well, okay. This is the first election, first party convention after the assassination of John Kennedy, just about 9 months earlier. Barry Goldwater, who had thought about being a candidate in 1960 and then stepped back, represented the conservative wing of the Republican Party. And he comes in being opposed by Nelson Rockefeller, perceived to be a liberal governor of New York, and also a moderate to liberal governor from Pennsylvania, William Scranton, and possibly even Richard Nixon sitting in the wings. So Goldwater comes in, and he wants to shift the party. He wants to shift the party away from the positions it has had with regard to the Vietnam War, with regard to the Cold War.
And let our republicanism, so focused and so dedicated, not be made fuzzy and futile by unthinking and stupid labels. I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Thank you. And let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
Ron Elving, some pretty loaded words, moderation. Extremism was, at that time, a contested idea, a contested word, was it not?
The context here, to some degree, is the struggle over the conservative movement's identity in the 50s and 60s. Should they go along with a kind of Eisenhower Republicanism, sometimes called Me Too Republicanism, that fit in more or less with the years of the New Deal and the heritage and legacy of FDR, or whether it should strike out and really pose itself as a stark difference from the big government Democrats or the big government Republicans, for that matter, and be much more of a, I think it's fair to say, although the term was not used at the time so much, libertarian vision of republicanism. And another context was 1964 was the year of the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah.
And just weeks before this convention, just a couple of weeks before this convention, Barry Goldwater had voted against the Civil Rights Act on the floor of the Senate, despite the fact that the majority of his own Republican senators were voting for it. And he stepped out and said, no, this is too much government telling people how to run their businesses and their public accommodations. We shouldn't do that. We should be on the other side here, even if that means we're identified with segregation. That was a pretty strong position. It was characterized as extremist by many people at the time, and many people called upon Goldwater to be more moderate, and he was very specifically rejecting that advice.
There's an interesting contrast going on at the Democratic Convention in 1964. This was in Atlantic City, where the legacy, of course, Tim Chambliss, of President Kennedy, who had been killed, as you say, the November before, I guess was a real presence in that convention.
Oh, yes, and there was tremendous pressure upon Lyndon Johnson by many delegates to have Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, the surviving brother, to be the running mate for Lyndon Johnson. And so Johnson declared, giving himself cover, that no member of the cabinet would be considered to be his running mate. And instead, Lyndon Johnson chose Hubert Humphrey, a longtime senator since 1948 from Minnesota, and who had led the way on having the 1964 Civil Rights Act approved by the Senate the month before, be his running mate.
But did Johnson want Bobby Kennedy speaking in 1964?
No. Now, Bobby Kennedy is going to give a tremendous speech. There's tremendous sympathy for Robert Kennedy. He, being denied that opportunity to be a running mate, he's going to turn right around and essentially, using an apartment address he has in New York, run for the U.S. Senate and defeat Republican incumbent Kenneth Keating in the 1964 Senate race in New York. But this was a time in which Lyndon Johnson and Robert Kennedy, in the words of Robert Carroll, the biographer for Lyndon Johnson, has said it's like two snarling dogs coming face to face with each other. That was the relationship that Kennedy and Johnson had.
Well, and it had been a bad one for a number of years. It had not begun even with the assassination of John Kennedy. It had been bad back into the 50s for a variety of reasons.
I want to play just a moment of Bobby Kennedy's speech there. And Ron Elving, I guess we should say, I mean, I think it took something like more than 10 minutes for the applause to die down for Bobby Kennedy in that speech in 1964.
Something of a protest, actually. They also showed a film of the life of JFK. And, of course, that was enormously emotional in the hall. It was probably the strongest moment of emotion in the entire convention that year. And then, of course, to have that followed up by his inheritor, his brother, his political alter ego, Bobby, to come out and give a speech. Just a tremendous upsurge of not rebellion against LBJ. He was clearly in charge, but they wanted to have at least their chance to show how much they loved the Kennedys.
And in all of these efforts, you were there, all of you. When there were difficulties, you sustained him. When there were periods of crisis, you stood beside him. When there were periods of happiness, you laughed with him. And when there were periods of sorrow, you comforted him. I realize that as an individual, that we can't just look back, that we must look forward. When I think of President Kennedy, I think of what Shakespeare said in Romeo and Juliet, when he shall die, take him and cut him out in little stars, and he shall make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun. But I realize, as an individual, and really realize that as an individual, and even more importantly, for a political party and for the country, that we can't just look to the past. We must look to the future.
I wanted to ask you about that last line there, Ron Elving, this idea. I think a couple of things come through in that. Just the sense of high drama that are possible in some of these conventions, moments of great energy, but also this idea of looking forward. That does seem to be the general idea. I wonder if you had something to say about that.
I suspect Bobby Kennedy was looking forward in terms of either 4 years or 8 years at that particular moment. But he was also talking about the more general sense of the future. And political parties, in a real sense, have their roots in the past. They function in the present, but they are ultimately all about the future. They're trying to control the future, to influence the future, to have the future be more like their vision for what the country should be. And Bobby Kennedy embodied that. He was an imperfect vessel, of course, in many ways, but he was powerful as a visionary and as someone who could cast the party's vision forward. Another famous line of his, of course, others see how things are and ask why. I see things as they have never been and ask why not.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's shift a little bit to what both of you are looking forward to or expecting, if anyone can predict what happens, I guess. Ron Elving, you first. What kind of a sense do you have about whether or not there will be, could potentially be, if not brokered, certainly a contested convention for the Republicans this year?
It's really hard to say at this point because it's going to depend entirely on how the voting goes from now on. It would be much easier for Ted Cruz to overtake Donald Trump if it were just a one-on-one struggle. But John Kasich remaining as a candidate really complicates the road forward for him. Donald Trump has, I would say, at least a 50-50 chance of getting to the convention with enough delegates to be nominated on the first ballot. If that is the case, I believe that is what will happen, and people who are unhappy will walk out. So you will have a broken convention, much as they had in 64 when the Nelson Rockefeller forces walked out on Barry Goldwater. It will not be a contested convention. It will nominate Donald Trump, but it will also be a broken party that goes forward, and there may be some sort of an effort to organize a third-party effort on the right to oppose Trump as well as the Democratic nominee.
What are you expecting?
Well, Donald Trump, having never run before, we've never had a candidate like Donald Trump before, whether it's a $4 or $10 billion businessman. The closest analogy might be Ross Perot in 92 and 96. But Donald Trump is a person who much of his life self-identified with the Democratic Party. And here he is. It's just unprecedented. He, in an honest, transparent election, he's gotten votes to be the leading candidate. And you see the Republican Party in the establishment wings of the Democratic Party, the Republican Party being astounded, stunned, and unsure how to proceed. They're losing control. And we're seeing the party almost imploding, exploding at this point. And it may, in the middle of July in Cleveland, metaphorically go over a political cliff, especially if we have a third party. Because if we do, that's going to result in part of the election of either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders.
What happens if no one comes out of that first ballot? Could a candidate not running emerge as a consensus candidate? You hear Speaker Ryan, Paul Ryan's name mentioned. You hear, at least in this state, you hear Mitt Romney's name mentioned, a titular head of the party. Ron Elving, is that even on the books as a possibility?
It's difficult, partly because of a rule that would have to be changed. They would have to change the rules, specifically Rule 40, which says you can't have your name placed in nomination at the convention, even on a later ballot, unless you have carried the majority of delegates from eight states.
Right.
Now, yeah, that's actually a rule that was put in by the Romney forces in 2012.
Isn't that ironic?
That's right.
It's ironic in the extreme because it's going to make it very difficult for Mitt or anyone else to leap in on a later ballot. They'll have to change that rule. So if we get to Cleveland and there is a rules committee that meets the week before the convention and it will be better covered than it has been in a very long time.
Right.
If Donald Trump does not have 1237, if he has so so many as 1236, but not 1237. Mm-hmm. If he can't get over the hump, then I suspect the Rules Committee changes that rule so that they'll have a fallback plan B if no one can get nominated on a first or a second or a third ballot and they need to go to some other names.
So who could that possibly be?
It could be Mitt Romney, the titular head of the party, the candidate in 2012, although he has said that he is not a candidate.
Yeah, they always say that.
But he has said that first to support one candidate, then another, you'll support a write-in, maybe support a third party. Now, this week, it's Ted Cruz, which is rather ironic given the fact that in 2012 it was the evangelical wing of the Republican Party that was fairly reticent in his support of Mitt Romney.
It's also possible that we could fall back to one of the other candidates,
sure.
Possibly somebody who has not won a majority of 8 states. Marco Rubio, possibly this mm-hmm. is why John Kasich is hanging around.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, his name has been mentioned. So if they change the rule, it's Katie bar the door, all come.
Right. Historically, it's been governors that have gotten the nominations and been elected because they've had to manage. If the Republican Party historically wants to win the election in 2016, they probably need a candidate from Ohio and from Florida, maybe a John Kasich, a governor, maybe a Marco Rubio, a senator with Latino heritage.
Let me ask you both finally, how important is it that whichever party, that they come out of their convention with a sense of unity? And it seems like there's a decent chance that both of these parties could come out with a good bit of dissent from various sides. Tim Chambliss, you first.
We're in Utah here, and it may be that if a Hillary Clinton and a Bernie Sanders agree to be running mates, that here in the state of Utah, where the last time a Democratic candidate, Lyndon Johnson, was approved by the voters, we could see the Democratic Party defeating the Republican Party candidate if that nominee is Donald Trump.
Wow.
Unity is the key to victory.
Yes.
Both parties have had many experiences with what happens when the party comes out split. 1912, of course, the classic, when a very large Republican force, a very large Republican dominance in American politics could be split and Woodrow Wilson could become president. We saw it on a much smaller scale when Ralph Nader, very mm-hmm. possibly, just this can't be mm-hmm. proven, but very possibly cost Al Gore the state of Florida in the year 2000 and thereby denied Al Gore the presidency and gave us George W. Bush. So party unity is critically important, even if it isn't an outright running against, a third party or fourth party of great force. It can be enough to siphon votes, even if it doesn't win any states. We saw that again with Ross Perot in 92, when he probably hurt George H.W. Bush pretty badly in his reelection effort. So mm-hmm. both parties are going to want to be as united as possible. And if one or the other is and the other isn't, it's a huge advantage in November.
It's Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. Joined us from Washington, D.C., the NPR studios there. Ron, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
And Tim Chambliss, professor of political science at the University of Utah, also affiliated with the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Professor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. Sophie Sirwa is our intern. Josh Weathers is producer for Video West, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.